Welcome, everyone, to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today, our topic is the neuroscience of creating intelligent workplaces. My name is Sue Bethanis, and I'm the founder and CEO of Mariposa Leadership, and I'm your host. For some of you, it's this evening, actually. I'm pleased that our guest today is Janet Crawford. Janet is the principal of Crawford Consulting. She's a senior leadership coach for Mariposa Leadership, and she's a former scientist with the EPA. For the last decade, Janet bridged the scientific and leadership development worlds by understanding how human biology and neuroscience inform and bolster leadership and organizational effectiveness. She is a certified coach through Newfield Network and is a certified master practitioner of neurolinguistic programming, NLP for short. That was a formal bio. Let me tell you that Jan and I have known each other for about 12 years, at least 12 years.
Wow.
And she was the first coach I asked to be on my team at Mariposa, so she holds a special place in my heart. She is an incredible coach and has a keen ability to teach in a very coherent and cogent way. I'm always impressed when I see her teach. And this is also Janet's second time to be with us on Wise Talk. So, Janet, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll be looking at three broad topics today and a very interesting topic, overall topic of neuroscience and leadership. And the first topic we're going to tackle is the role of the leader in building brain-friendly working environments. The second topic is focusing attention and how to create and learning and change-friendly organizations. And the third one is building strategically intelligent workplaces. As usual, we have a full house and have a diverse group of people both inside large companies as well as coaches and consultants. I know some of you are here just to listen and others will have questions. After each topic, I will definitely call for questions because I want you to be able to make this as relevant as possible. We have changed the way we administer the call this time and to try to eliminate the background noise. So I have all of you on mute now. I'm going to do that right now. And except for Janet. you called into the moderator code, I assume.
Yes, I did.
Okay. And when we call for the question and answer after each section, then I will unmute everyone. And we are recording the session, and we will get this on our website in probably middle of next week. So here we go. Mm-hmm. Let's start out with what I like to call a so what type of question.
Okay.
So, Janet, what does neuroscience add to the leadership conversation?
Well, I think it adds a few things. One is that the nature of work has really changed, and we haven't caught up with that.
Mm-hmm.
So in today's marketplace, for most of the companies, at least the companies that we work in, intelligence is the asset. The old economic model is that labor, capital, land are your assets, and those are still assets, but the main thing that's a competitive advantage for organizations is intelligence. And it's not even knowledge. We talk about knowledge economies.
Mm-hmm.
And knowledge, content knowledge changes rapidly every day
mm-hmm.
in today's economy, but the intelligence of the people in the organization are what allow you to act quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So you want people that can think in novel ways, that can sort through overload of information and pay attention to what's relevant,
mm-hmm.
Who can coordinate action smoothly with other people, who know how to have generative conversations, who make good decisions quickly, who can be flexible, all of those sorts of things. And we've never before placed a set of demands like that on an entire organization.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the old organizational practices that used to work don't work so well anymore. So we can start to understand, by understanding neuroscience, how to leverage intelligence better and to build practices that are consistent with intelligence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We've also become really out of sync with our biology. Technology's outstripped our ability to use the technology that we've created.
Mm.
We're introducing an amount of newness and things to remember into people's lives that is unprecedented.
Yeah, like every minute.
Yeah, exactly. We're bombarded by information,
right.
And we're bombarded by choices. And
mm-hmm.
there's this shiny ball phenomenon where there's stuff flying past us all the time, and it's very difficult to discern what we should be choosing and not choosing.
Okay.
There's demands of time zones and travel and all of the old rhythms of life where we had fallow periods between the harvests and all of that. That's gone now.
Mm-hmm.
So we really need new tools for discernment that weren't really necessary before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no fallow periods now.
Exactly.
It's all harvest.
So we give lip service to a lot of the good practices that are congruent with our biology. A lot of these are just, when we hear them, it's like, well, that makes just good intuitive sense. But we actually don't practice them with rigor.
Mm-hmm.
They're viewed as nice to haves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good introduction. Another question that's related is, how does our understanding of leadership need to shift in order to build a successful intelligent-based organization? So what are some of these shifts we have to do to catch up?
Well, a lot of this is going to show up, I think, as we go along in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But succinctly put, I would just say that the primary job of great leadership now is optimizing and leveraging the collective intelligence of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about what you know. It's not about your ability to create great strategy. It's not about your ability to create processes. It's about, are you behaving in a way that brings forth the intelligence of each and every person in your organization?
Mm-hmm.
And are you modeling that for them?
Cool. And what would be an example of how to do that? Just give us one now. I know.
Yeah, I'll give you one now, and we'll probably expand on this one later.
Sure.
One of the things that leaders need to be doing is listening intently to the kinds of conversations their people are having and introducing conversations that prime their brains to pay attention to the kinds of things that they need to be paying attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And we just trust that people are talking about what they need to talk about, but they're usually not. And as coaches, we have an inside window into that world, and we know that that's true.
Mm-hmm.
We know what the private conversations are, and we know what the public conversations are.
Mm-hmm.
And what we think about and what we talk about has a profound influence on what we can notice and, in fact, what we can think. So as a leader, you need to be really attuned to those conversations and be actively shaping them.
So do you mean like when we're walking around, for example, a lot of the places we work have cubes? And cubicles. And do you mean walking around and kind of tuning yourself to what people are, the problems are solving?
That's one example.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of leaders are profoundly isolated.
Mm-hmm.
They're dealing with their people through email. They're not actually out noticing what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But another example is a lot of team meetings, and I'm privileged to get to sit in on team meetings in a variety of different organizations. And oftentimes, the main purpose of having a team meeting is just doing kind of a bulk report out.
Yeah.
And half the people in the room are asleep because it's simple information overload.
Or they're on their email.
Or they're on their email, or they're doing other things.
Mm-hmm.
And what we don't view as being a purpose of those weekly team meetings is talking about certain topics that you want people to be attentive to.
Mm-hmm.
For example, strategy doesn't happen as a one-time event, and we may talk about this a little bit later in the call. You really want people to be noticing certain things in the marketplace on a regular basis. And having their brains attuned to those things. And we'll talk about the brain science when we get there. But we tend not to talk about those sorts of things because they're not urgent.
Yeah, okay, because it's too far in the future. Okay,
yeah.
So let's get into some of the these more specifics around applying neuroscience. You call this brain-friendly working environment.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the neuroscience behind a brain, I like this, brain-friendly working environment, or BFWE for short?
Okay.
It has a nice ring to it.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of the people on the call are probably familiar with the triune brain, and probably a lot of you aren't. So we're going to start there, just so that everybody's on the same page. And I learned a trick from a wonderful neuroscientist who works down at UCLA named Dan Siegel in order for people to have kind of a kinesthetic experience of what this is. So if you hold your hand up in front of you, kind of sideways,
mm-hmm.
and you look at your wrist, you can think of your wrist as being the first part of the triune brain. And by the way, triune just means three in one, tri for three, un for one. So human beings have a three-in-one brain. Other animals don't. mammals do, but you go much below there on the evolutionary ladder, and they don't have triune brains. They have diurne brains, and then they're just one part of the brain. So the most primitive part of the brain is the reptilian brain, which you can think of as being kind of the wrist up into the bottom palm of your hand. And the reptilian brain is very much concerned with survival. It does base-level things like reproduction. A lot of the autonomic body functions are controlled there. And it really just wants to keep you alive. So it responds to situations where you're in a great deal of danger. And it takes over and creates a fight, flight, or freeze phenomenon. So that's kind of the lowest part of the brain. It's not what we think about when we talk about brains, but it's actually in many respects the most important because it is what keeps us alive. If you damage that part of the brain, you will die. So that keeps us out of trouble. Yeah, and that's the first level of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
The second level you can imagine as being your thumb. So fold your thumb over in front of the palm of your hand, and that's what we're going to call the limbic system. And the limbic system is the emotional center of the brain. It takes care of both emotions and memory. And by the way, it's equally active in men and women. A lot of people say, oh, well, that's kind of more what women have, and that's absolutely not true. It just functions a little bit differently. So the limbic system has something that's interesting about it, which is it doesn't know the difference between imagination and reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it also has a little structure called the amygdala, and we'll imagine that that's your thumbnail. So the amygdala is really critical in organizational success, and so I'll refer to the amygdala a lot because what that part of the brain does is it's really the gateway between deciding whether or not the reptilian brain should handle a situation or the higher levels of the brain should handle that situation.
So when we're in a situation where we're challenged and we want to fight somebody, we're not going to say hit them, hopefully, but we're going to fight with our words. The amygdala will decide whether our impulse will be to fight or to stop or to run.
Exactly. So the amygdala is kind of the trigger. Actually, the amygdala doesn't exactly decide, but it's we'll go with that for the moment. But it starts to warm up as it feels threat in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And if it gets too warm, then it does what's called an amygdala hijack. So we'll come back to that in a moment, but I want to introduce the third part of the brain, which is the neocortex. So if you fold your fingers over your thumb, and now you've got a fist with your thumb in the middle of it, your fingers are the neocortex. So you've got your wrist, the reptilian system, your thumb that's kind of nestled in the center of it, your limbic system, and then your neocortex over the outside of it. And the neocortex is where all of these higher-level functions that we think about when we think about being human, most of those, I mean, obviously emotion we think about too, but when we think about higher-level thought processes, those are all in that upper part. And that neocortex has a portion called the prefrontal cortex, which is right behind your forehead. And that part of the brain is extremely important in organizational success because it handles things like impulse control, fear moderation, future thinking. I mean, think about strategy, the ability to think out into the future and predict responses, empathy, attuned communication, morality, all of those things are in the prefrontal cortex. That's kind
of discernment, a lot of discernment.
Discernment. All of that's kind of wrapped around the limbic system, in contact with the limbic system. Now, as you start to perceive threat and the amygdala warms up, there's a communication that goes back and forth between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala.
Yep.
The prefrontal cortex is the one that can discern between true threat and threat that's really not too dangerous.
Because the limbic system doesn't understand the difference between reality and imagination. So the prefrontal cortex has to decide.
Well, in part, that. But also we have these things in the limbic system which are emotional memories that get triggered. And they have to do with the past. And the prefrontal cortex can kind of remain in the present and say, you know what, I know that you're feeling triggered by this, but it's really not a threat now.
Okay, I see.
And so there's this kind of communication that goes back and forth. The stronger the prefrontal cortex is, the more ability it has to calm the amygdala down.
And this is, of course, happening within half a second or something.
Split second.
Yeah, yeah.
If the prefrontal cortex can't calm the amygdala down, or if it says, you know what, go ahead and fire because this is a real threat, you know, I'm being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, let's get the heck out of here, then the amygdala warms up to such a point that it flips our lid. And what that looks like is the whole hand just comes apart.
And that's when we yell.
That's when we, yeah. So in a primitive context, we're running away from the saber-toothed tiger, or we're hiding behind a tree, or we're doing something to protect our very survival.
Okay.
When we get into the corporate boardroom, we're doing things like sarcasm, yelling, shutting down, passive-aggressive behaviors, avoiding phone calls. Those sorts of things are oftentimes the result of an overactive amygdala.
Okay.
And our amygdalas are going through this process of warming up and cooling down continuously day in and day out. People who are more highly functional in organizational settings tend to have calmer amygdalas, and they have stronger prefrontal cortexes. So one of the main practices, or one of the main principles of neuroscience that's applied to organizations is, as a leader and as an individual, how do you create an organization where you've got really healthy prefrontal cortexes and really calm amygdalas?
Mm-hmm.
So that's really key and central.
And that would, what you're considering a brain-friendly working environment.
That's part of a brain-friendly working environment, one of the biggest pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second piece is really understanding, and there's a lot of pieces, but the pieces that I'll concentrate on are really understanding learning and change.
Mm-hmm.
Change is really difficult for people because we have what we do in order to learn is that over our lifetimes we start sorting through all of the stuff that's in the universe, and we've got, you know, millions of inputs coming at us at any given moment, and we need to be able to sort through all those inputs and decide what's important to pay attention to and what to ignore. And so over our lifetime we start to discern or learn what's important to us in order for us to have a functional life. Now, the patterns that I have in my brain are going to be completely different from the patterns of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
That's why if an interior designer walks into a room, they see different things than a computer programmer sees walking into the same room.
Right.
Because what's important in their worlds are different. So what we do is we lay down all of these neural patterns in our brain, both content patterns and emotional patterns. So we learn that a certain expression has a certain meaning, and we learn that by the people that we've been exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for me, my interpretation of a particular expression is going to be different from yours because my past history with people has been different.
Sure, sure.
We tend to assume that it's all the same, though.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you see the way he looked? So we've got those patterns, and the problem with them is that they both allow us to be functional in life. If we didn't have them, we couldn't function at all. We tend to wax philosophical about and rhapsodic about the wonder of childhood, but you think about a kid, they can't function without an adult that's pruned out the randomness of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So we have those patterns, and when we try to change, it's actually viewed in our brain as a threat because the way we interpret our own patterns are these are the things that allow me to be functional in the world, and the brain is really loath to mess with those.
Mm-hmm.
And they're located in a different part of the brain than the logical part of the brain. So in organizations, we tend to think, okay, let's just be logical. Let's explain why we need to do this. And then everybody should do it, right?
But then the change is thought of as a threat, so it goes into your emotional part of, yeah.
And so everybody kind of goes into a fear-based reaction to it, and their amygdalas are firing, and even sometimes they don't understand why they're feeling that way. And you can see this really clearly. My favorite example of this is if change were logical, we wouldn't have a diet industry. We wouldn't.
Exactly.
Everybody would understand that they should eat better and how they should eat, and they just do it.
They would just do it, yeah. So let's stop a second, because I want to give people a chance to to absorb and ask questions or make comments. I know there's a couple people on the phone that are if Judy Glazer is on the phone, she's been with us before in Wise Talk, and she's spent a lot of time doing some brain science work as well. So I know that a lot of you might have questions or comments. So let me unmute everybody. Who would like to ask a question of Janet?
I think she had everybody.
Anyone?
Anyway.
Hello? Hello?
Hi, we can hear you.
Okay, someone sounded like just made a comment. I thought they were asking a question. Does anyone have a question of Janet?
Not yet.
It's either really confusing,
okay,
or very clear.
Yeah, is there any specifics anyone want to bring up? We'll just keep moving on if you don't have any questions.
The only question that I would have, this is Nancy Duranto.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Nancy.
In terms of what you just said around the change being difficult,
mm-hmm,
based on the fact the way our brain is wired, so what do you do about that? And that may be where you're headed.
We are, but you can go ahead and answer it now.
A couple of things. One more additional thing about the way the brain functions is that we actually have this very interesting brief second that we can decide whether to do something different or not. And when you all try this on, I think you'll recognize this phenomenon inside your own brain, which is you have that split second decision where you decide to do something the way you used to do it or decide to do it the new way.
Mm.
And it's actually it's a conscious split second. For those of you who've read Leadership and Self-Deception, they refer to this little split second is the moment where you decide to make a self-justifying explanation or do the new behavior. So you, from the time all the input comes into you from the environment and you run it through all of your sensory apparatus and then you run it through all of these patterns that you have in your limbic system that tell you how to interpret it, and do all the processing, to the time that you have an impulse to do something is approximately a third of a second.
Oh, my gosh.
It's about 0.3 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's just lightning fast.
Sure.
And then you've got about 0.2 seconds to make a decision whether or not to follow your impulse. And that's the conscious window. I mean, think about that. It's 0.2 seconds that you have to make a decision to do something different. So you better be prepared to know what it is you want to do differently. Because if you don't have a really clear message to send your brain about what you want to do differently, that window's come and gone before you can blink.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things, is that you have to have a clear, consistent message about what needs to happen differently, both to your organization and to yourself. And you also need to be aware that that window is going to come up over and over again, and that is your chance to catch yourself. That's the only chance that you have. So when you have that little feeling of that conscious blip of its decision time, don't give yourself a decision in there. Simply say, this is the new way that I'm going to go, and that's veto. That's called veto power, actually, in brain science.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the healthier your prefrontal cortex is, and we'll talk in a moment about what creates a healthy prefrontal cortex, the stronger your prefrontal cortex is, the stronger your ability to take advantage of that 0.2 second window becomes.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you do this, the more you consciously make choice like that, the stronger your ability becomes to do that, which they're starting to think is the reason that meditation seems to be so beneficial to people. Because what will happen in that 0.2 seconds is that you feel very uncomfortable. Change is actually uncomfortable. That we have an error detection circuitry that says, do it the old way, and if you don't do it the old way, it sends a threat signal out. It says, this is not how you've done it before. It's a little dangerous because it's new. And that threat signal is actually, it sends a feeling of discomfort into your body. And so the ability to sit through that discomfort is what allows for change. So part of
the
it
meditators,
is
in other words, can sit through the discomfort easier?
Right, because okay. Meditation is a practice of simply observing yourself and being with what is.
So you're able to sit with it and not be freaked out by it.
Exactly. It's just
okay.
Like, oh, there it is. Hello, discomfort.
Yeah, right. Sounds so easy, Janet. Okay, let's stop a second because I want to make sure. Does anyone else have a question at this point before we move on to more about change particularly?
Yeah, and Nancy, we will get to more on change.
Does that suffice so far, Nancy?
Well, I do have one. From
yeah, no, it absolutely does.
Okay, great. Okay, someone else has a question. Who is it?
One of the things that I've seen is it seems like there are some people who tend to thrive on change.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem to be as difficult for them. I wondered if you could speak to that.
And who just spoke?
This is Jan Newcomb.
Hi, Jan.
Hi.
Great.
That's a really interesting question. And I don't have the definitive answer for that. I think it's actually a really interesting question for neuroscience research. But what I would have to say about that is the degree that change is viewed as something that could possibly result in negative circumstances for us, we will resist it.
Sure.
And to the extent that change is imposed on us from the outside, we will resist it,
mm-hmm.
which are actually key concepts for leadership. Because when people generate a novel idea, it actually... there's a positive brain chemistry that's generated. So our brains actually like to make new neural connections, but they don't like to disrupt what's already worked. And so you've got those two forces kind of counterbalancing each other.
Yeah.
So if people are involved in generating the change, and if part and parcel of generating the change is that you create a really positive emotional context around it, then you've counterbalanced the threat with a positive input on the other side. And I think some of the people that have that kind of love of change have a natural tendency to do what in neurolinguistics would be called positive future pacing. They get excited about the future possibility that will be generated by the change, and they spend a lot of time thinking about that. And what that does is it actually primes all of the neural circuits in their brain that are associated with the positive feeling.
And they're already ready for it, kind of thing?
And they're ready and excited about it.
Yeah, okay. That's good. That's actually a really good – that's a good answer. You may have to do research on it, but that actually makes a lot of sense. Okay.
Well, I'm constantly generating things that make logical sense that haven't actually been verified scientifically. So.
Yeah, well. Okay, let's stop for a second. I wanted to continue this discussion about change-friendly organizations, and I have a couple of questions on that. The one question is, we've been talking about this idea of rewiring our brain, and I'm wondering if there's a way to rewire our brain to be more targeted in our attention in order to become, to overcome information overwhelm. So it's kind of a loaded question, but I'm wondering what we can do about this constancy of things coming at us and if we can rewire our brain to focus our attention. Because we're an ADD society, essentially, and I say that in quotes. So it's coming at us pretty quickly here. So is there a way, can we do this from a brain perspective or just are we doomed here?
We absolutely can rewire our brains in a larger sense than just managing overwhelm. It's very exciting right now that we're starting to understand that even things that are genetically based like depression and obsessive-compulsive disorder are subject to mindful practices. So we can actually even overcome some of our genetics and rewire.
Okay.
The brain is an incredibly plastic organ. And so the way we live our life, the thoughts that we have, the conversations that we have, the practices that we engage in are incredibly important in terms of generating who we are as people. Now, in terms of the overwhelm question,
yeah.
There are a lot of things that we can do to deal with overwhelm. And the problem is that if you go back to the kind of beginning time, the primitive time of human history, which is not that far back, evolutionarily speaking, our brains are designed to look for what's novel and new. They're designed to look for the shiny ball. If it's shiny and if it moves, if it's new and it moves, we should pay attention to it. that's because if you're out hunting and gathering and trying to defend against a predator, what are you looking for? You're looking for the bright, shiny fruit. You're looking for the predator that moves. You're looking for the game that's hiding in the bush. So we're constantly attuned to those things. But now we live in this consumer society where there's stuff whizzing by us every moment. There's stuff coming in the mail. There's stuff coming on the email. It's just a complete constant overwhelm for most people. And that's when I say technology's outstripped our biological ability to deal
with
it.
Right.
You know, I deal with this all the time because every time I put a new program, I put iTunes on my computer about a month ago. Big mistake. So how do we deal with that? Part of it is just becoming conscious of it. Really sitting down and thinking about what is it that's in your world. Review your whole day. Review the way, and this is where coaching can be very important for people because it helps them sit and reflect. So where are the places that things come into your environment that distract you and have you pay attention to them when it's not really in your best interest? And review those things, decide what it is that's important to pay attention to, and select a strategy for dealing with the things that aren't important. And that's just common sense. But what will happen is that if you don't consciously think it, there's no neural pathway there when the bright, shiny ball rolls across in front of you. You just follow it.
Yeah.
But if you've already thought, when that ball rolls in front of me, here's what I'm going to do, it's like there's a pathway that gets triggered as soon as you see it.
You
and that's, that's actually that choice point, that 0.2-second choice point where you go, oh, that's the bright, shiny ball, and I decided not to do that.
So, Janet, when you say get conscious, I mean, I think that everyone can understand that. But I think what's different in what you're saying is that it's almost like an anticipatory kind of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So if, and of course, we do that in meditation. We can simulate that. But I'm thinking, just assuming people don't do meditation, if they were merely to know that this bright, shiny ball, these things are going to be coming at them, and be aware that not to be almost suckered into it. It's almost like that we don't want to get people to get suckered into it.
Mm-hmm.
That if they know that they are potentially doing that, that they can stop themselves in that 0.2 seconds.
Right. The other thing that is important to understand is that our biology will tell us to be uncomfortable when we ignore those things. And to just understand that, especially when we first start ignoring some of them, that it's going to feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, and this is going to sound silly, but at one point I realized that somewhere along the line I had learned that it was important to read all your mail. Now, that was a neural pathway that I had as a belief in my brain. And so the mail would come in, and it didn't matter whether it was an ad for a new mortgage, which I don't need. I'd open it and read it.
Don't you have like four of those a day, Jen?
Well, I don't do it anymore.
Oh, good.
But, you know, there was this compulsion that I had to read all the mail because mail's important. And this was a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
Sorry.
Okay.
So there was a conscious moment where I said, oh, you know what? I'm not getting any benefit from that behavior. I know that they're throwing all of these glossy, you know, beautiful brochures at me.
Shiny balls.
They're shiny balls. But that's not key to getting done what I need to do in my life. And so I'm going to give myself about 30 seconds to go through the mail, if that. And if it's not absolutely at the top of my priority list, it goes in the trash can. Now, the human brain is afraid of missing something.
Yeah.
You know, this FMS.
FMS. Yep.
And so there's a feeling of discomfort. There might have been a shiny ball in there that would be beneficial to my survival, and I might have just thrown it out. And so I'm giving a very trite example just for the purpose of clarity, but that kind of decision comes at us all day long. And when we first start to decide to ignore something, it feels uncomfortable because it brings up that sense of, am I missing something that might be important, especially if we've been taught somewhere along the way that it was important?
Well, would it also be, does our brain process such that if, in terms of our prioritization, if we let go of this shiny ball, there'll be another shiny ball that we'll be able to deal with? Does it actually know, does our brain...
It doesn't really know that in the moment.
Okay.
And so that's where, again, using the prefrontal cortex, that little slice of conscious decision-making becomes so important, which is, again, why the prefrontal cortex is so important. By the way, only about, much less than 1% of our processing is actually conscious.
Mm-hmm.
So it behooves us to really use our conscious attention wisely. And part of that decision-making process, the other side of it, which we as coaches do a lot of with clients, is really helping people become aware of what their priorities are and what's important to them.
Mm-hmm.
So in that moment that you have a decision about where you're going to go, you can say, this is not key to fill in the blank, to my most important priority. I'm going to let it go, and I'm going to sit with that split second of discomfort when I'm letting it go or when I'm deleting the email or whatever it is. If we don't know what's most important to us, we don't have that touchstone to make the decision with.
Mm-hmm. So the last two sections here, we've talked about the brain, triune brain specifically. We've talked about impulse control. We've talked about attention. We've talked about overwhelm. We've talked about a lot of things. So what I like to do for me and for the folks on the phone is name, let's say, two or three. Let's say two for now. What are some specific practices that leaders can do that they can take care of their brains? I like that. That was a question that we came up with together. Like, what can we do to take care of our own brains? What's a practice or two that we can do?
So before I answer that, I'm going to say that the most important thing that leaders can do is manage their own brain first before they even try to manage the organization.
Right.
Because there is a phenomenon called limbic resonance and limbic regulation,
mm-hmm.
whereby the presence of one brain attunes to the other brains around it. And so emotions leak. We all know this, that one person's mood affects the mood of other people, but we now know how it works in a neuroscience perspective. And managers and leaders that have calm amygdalas tend to calm the amygdalas of everyone around them. So it's critically important that the manager or leader model the healthy practices. So what are some of those? Probably first and foremost is attending to your health, getting enough sleep. And that's, I think, an enormous problem in organizations. That I think the majority of the people that I work with are sleep deprived.
And that affects the way our prefrontal cortex can
Absolutely.
Process?
It affects the entire brain.
Right.
And in fact, there have been some studies that suggest that driving under sleep debt is as or more dangerous than driving drunk.
The combination is really bad.
Yeah, exactly. And that our ability to make good decisions drops. How warmed up our amygdala is, our amygdalas become warmed up, kind of chronically warmed up when we're sleep deprived. And this makes a lot of sense, right? Because if you're sleep deprived, you can't pay as close attention. So you better react more strongly to any threat that comes into the system.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not really primed to make good decisions.
Okay, so first thing would be
sleep.
To make sure you sleep. Okay.
Get good sleep. Be very rigorous about that.
How else should we take care of our brain?
All of the things that promote good health, good eating patterns. A critical one is limit your caffeine use, because caffeine actually warms up the amygdala and can actually, with chronic use over time, they're suspecting may cause some chronic damage in the brain in terms of making us more reactive. So we all know that when we're amped up on caffeine, there's that kind of reactive mode that people get into. And a lot of people are using caffeine as a way to deal with their sleep deprivation.
Yeah,
to keep them awake difficult. Through meetings where there's too much information being thrown at them.
You said about caffeine warming up the amygdala, because back at the beginning you talked about how the amygdala gets warm and it takes our prefrontal cortex to basically to know what to do. The choice point is there. And so, but there's a way that caffeine is contributing to our amygdalas being more warm than they should be.
Absolutely. So you get somebody who's sleep deprived, that warms up the amygdala,
mm-hmm.
and then they start taking caffeine to counteract the fact that they haven't mm-hmm. slept enough, and it warms the amygdala even more.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the prefrontal cortex has a chemical called GABA that is kind of a firefighting chemical.
G-A-B-A?
G-A-B-A.
Okay.
You can actually buy it at your health food store. It's kind of fun stuff.
Okay.
But it actually cools down the amygdala. And so when the prefrontal cortex says, hey, this is not a real threat, it secretes GABA and it cools the amygdala down. The only problem is if you've got, you only have a certain supply of GABA. You have more of it when you're meditating and you're healthy and all of that. So your capacity to secrete GABA increases. But if you're not being healthy, that decreases at the same time that the amygdala gets warmed up. And so you've just created a situation where somebody is very easy to trigger. Those are two kind of health practices. Exercise promotes good brain health. There's some indication that neural plasticity or neural growth is encouraged by aerobic exercise. So we actually grow more neural connections and learn more easily when we're in good aerobic health.
And that doesn't have anything to do with the highs we get from it. That's different. That's a hormone.
I don't really know the difference there. I'm suspecting that it doesn't. But one thing that aerobic exercise does do is that when we have these little amygdala hijacks all the way through the day, our amygdala warms up and cools down and that sort of thing, what happens when we have a full-fledged amygdala hijack, and by the way, that's what that's called when the amygdala gets so hot that it flips our lid, is that you have a whole bunch of stress hormones that get secreted into the body. And those stress hormones are actually designed to fuel your reaction. Well, in a primitive environment where you run away from the saber-toothed tiger,
that's good.
You burn them off.
Right.
When you're
sitting
across somebody in a boardroom and you say something snide, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things build up in your system. And one of the theories around aerobic exercise is that it provides that running away from the saber-toothed tiger where it clears that stuff out of your system.
I think there's saber-toothed tigers too there, Janet.
Yeah, really? I may have to coin
I'll have to coin that one.
I've been noticing that's what I want to say.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's stop. This is great. Let's stop a second and take everybody off mute. And who has a question or comment? We keep getting into more juicy stuff. Basically, we need to sleep, we need to drink less caffeine, and we need to meditate.
Yes, I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yeah, who is it?
This is Inda.
Oh, hi, Inda.
Inda Bogel.
Hi, Inda.
How are you doing, Sue and Janet?
Good.
This is such a great talk. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you if how things like altruism and doing good deeds, you know, actually affects our brain, and in these practices to take care of, you know, our brain, how do they impact?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a great question, Ender, and it's not really one that I've considered from a brain science perspective, so I'm going to speculate for a moment, which is that the prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain that's concerned with empathy. So that when we involve ourselves in empathic kinds of activities, we are developing that part of the brain. And we do know that people that practice compassion meditation, when they take a look at the brain scans, there's up to 10 times as much neural activity in the part of the brain that is responsible for compassion. So my guess is that involving yourself in altruistic kinds of behaviors and practices puts attention on the part of the brain that is responsible for those things, and that those activities or the responsibility for those activities do occur in the prefrontal cortex. So my guess is that that would be a strengthening kind of activity.
Mm-hmm. That's a good guess. Makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, in corporations, I feel like the main emphasis is on getting the job done,
mm-hmm.
and doing what you need to do. You're accountable for your own thing, and you just take care of yourself. And I'm just looking at, like, well, you know, what if there was an altruistic, you know, intention in the organization?
Well,
you know, how it would change the leadership and everybody's contribution collectively.
That's a great point, because part of our the metaphor within which we live is a very machine-based metaphor. You know, each person is a cog in the wheel. Each person produces their part of things. And if we just put all of those things together, we'll have a functioning organization. And human brains are actually very attuned to connection, to limbic connection. When we don't have it, we become, actually our amygdalas warm up because we are socially designed. Again, in a primitive society, and it's true of our society as well, if you don't have a place within that society, an identity within that society, if there's nobody that cares about you, that's a profound threat to your survival. And so in organizations where there's this ethic of just everybody go do their work, you know, and let's leave emotion out of it, and let's leave the need for social connection out of things, our brains are starved. And they become worried that that's not there. So it's critically important for people to have a sense of belonging, to have a sense of caring about other people that they work with, a sense of connection, because that's really we're really designed for that. We're designed to be social animals, and we don't function well when we're not doing that. So thank you for bringing that up, Ender. And actually, I want to comment on that for a second, because there's a kind of a sub-bullet in there, which I think is critically important, and that has to do with social exclusion and status, which there's been a lot of brain research on recently. So all social animals have status ladders. Are you the VP? Are you the president? We have marital status. Are you married, not married, divorced, etc.? There are multiple status ladders that we operate within. Each culture has a status ladder. And people, a lot of our behavior has to do with sorting out where are we on the status hierarchy. Now, we're not conscious of that because it's a biologically driven phenomenon. When we get into organizations, it's really critically important that everybody feel like they have status, which doesn't mean that everybody has to have a vice president title. But what it means is that everybody has to have an identity that's respected and that has dignity.
A place.
They have to have a place,
yeah.
And that place has to have a sense of dignity to
mm-hmm.
it, because when they do,
mm-hmm.
all of the stuff, all of the primitive circuitry around status calms down, because I have a place in the organization, I'm safe. I have a place in this system, I'm safe. When we have breaches of trust, and when we have organizations where people impose status on other people, it becomes very threatening to our primitive brain, and
mm-hmm.
we react from that place. We don't know that that's why we're doing it, but we do.
Mm-hmm.
So in order for an organization to function really smoothly and to have a group of people that are operating primarily out of their prefrontal cortex, you want to neutralize the issue of status as much as possible.
I see. Interesting.
So one of the ways that you can do that, actually, really simple, and we teach this all the time, is being an inquiry. When you inquire into somebody else's thinking, you confer status on them automatically.
Mm-hmm.
You confer status.
You give them
status.
You
ask somebody their opinion.
Give them respect. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Exactly.
That's great. Okay. Let's move on. I wanted to ask a couple of questions about strategically intelligent workplaces.
Okay.
And the first question is all about strategic plans. So, a lot of companies, a lot of organizations, not just corporations, a lot of companies and organizations do strategic plans, and many times these plans sit on a shelf or business conditions change so rapidly that they're dated almost before they start.
Mm-hmm.
So in your view, Janet, is there a kind of planning that is more brain-friendly than this?
Yeah, and one of the things ties to what we just mentioned, which is inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
The more you include multiple layers of the organization in strategic planning, the more robust it will be, because you'll get more information, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that sense of inclusion creates a kind of a commitment that doesn't exist otherwise. Second thing that you can do is express strategy as narrative. Tell it as a story. Our brains are...
Say more about that, yeah.
Our brains are designed to learn through story.
And say, why is that?
And we can look back at Because what we do is we actually try to try to make a coherent pattern
mm-hmm.
out of what's happening in the universe. You look around, there's all of this random data that's happening. And
okay.
in order to organize it, we try to put it into a storyline
mm-hmm.
that
makes sense. Makes total sense. Okay.
That organizes what's happened in the past in order to generate the present and projects it out into the future to predict what might happen. So our brains are constantly doing that, trying to organize the stream of data into something that makes sense of the universe.
Okay.
And so when we present when we do strategy creation by getting a few people at the top of the corporation who are in an isolated bubble anyway, and they produce a strategic plan, and then they roll it out to the organization by giving a bunch of PowerPoint presentations that have a list of bullet points. It's kind of meaningless to the people more than one or two levels down. And there's also not a sense of commitment or engagement in it because they didn't help to create it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we didn't say earlier is that learning oftentimes happens through aha moments. When we have a moment of having created something in our brain, it actually creates neural fireworks. It's fascinating to see the brain scans of this happening. It's like a little braingasm almost.
Mm-hmm.
There's just all of this neural circuitry that's firing off. It's a very pleasant sensation when we have a moment of understanding or a moment of aha. And if what you do with strategy is you don't allow anybody in the organization to have that moment of understanding and wow, and you just give them a bullet point, there's nothing that creates any kind of neural firework. And so it kind of goes in one ear and out the other.
Mm-hmm.
And
so,
you wonder why people aren't engaged with the strategy or don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's part of it. The other piece is how do you make strategy sustainable, which is that you can create these strategic plans, but business conditions change so rapidly that, you know, a month from now, 3 months, 6 months from now, what you created may no longer be entirely valid.
Mm-hmm.
And you really want your organization to be strategically savvy. You want to have everybody out there at the ground level noticing the trends and feeding the information back, noticing opportunities and feeding that information back. And the way that you can do that is back to that whole concept of managing the conversation that your team is having. Ask them to think about the future. What trends do you see happening? What do you think might happen 6 months from now, a year from now, 5 years from now? And the key to this is not a game of trying to predict what will happen. And this is where the resource for this month comes in handy, The Living Company by Ari DeGuise, a fascinating book. And he was a master strategist for Royal Dutch Shell. And one of his strategies in terms of creating a strategic organization is, or one of his key points is, you don't ask people to predict the future. What you do is you ask them to think about several possible directions that the future could take, and then ask, if that direction came to pass, what then?
Okay.
What are the actions
that
we would want to take if that possible future came to pass? And what that does is it creates a neural pathway for anybody who has that thought. So the example that shows up in his book, which makes it really clear, he lives in London. So his example is he's doing work in Paris, and he's thinking about maybe going out to dinner with some people that he's working with, not sure if it's going to happen or not. And what happens in his brain, it's what would happen to any of us, is he starts going into, well, if they're available for dinner, I'll go to dinner with them, and I'll reserve a spot on the, you know, such and such, or I'll take the tunnel back, but if that doesn't work, I'll take the ferry back that leaves at X hour. You know, so you're going through all of these mental calculations about, if this happens, then I'll do this, but if that happens, then I'll do this other thing. And you're driving along, and the radio announcer says something about a strike going on in the ferry that takes you from Paris to London.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're not in the middle of that mental conversation, you won't hear that. It's background noise. But if you're in the middle of that what-if conversation, you hear that and you pay attention to it. So that's what happens in an organization where you've created strategic intelligence. Strategic intelligence is that each person in the organization has a set of if this, then that. And those templates that they're carrying around in their mind then attune them to information in the environment that would be useful to be fed back into the organization. If they haven't had those conversations, that information just passes right by them. It's not relevant.
It's an attunement.
Yeah.
Good.
So what we're doing is actually called brain priming, is that any time we think about a particular thing, it primes us to notice things in the environment that are congruent with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you want to do is manage the conversation so that you're bringing up on a consistent basis the question of, so if this happened, what do you think we should do?
That's good.
And then you've got a whole army of people out there who are gathering reconnaissance from the marketplace instead of just a couple people on top creating strategy that gets outdated in a month or two.
Right. Well, I like the idea of going down a couple different paths and seeing what could happen. That's good.
Exactly.
We've got to stop. Amazingly, we're at time.
It always happens this way.
Yeah, right. So, again, thank you so much for all your insights. I'm going to remember this thumb in my and my prefrontal cortex over my thumb, my wrist being my reptilian brain. I won't forget that one. I liked it.
Well, thank Dan Siegel for
that. Okay. A couple of announcements. You can go to MariposaLeadership.com to get this particular Wise Talk recording next week, as well as all the rest of, I think, 30. We're at 30 different Wise Talk recordings in the past 2 years. And also within probably 2 weeks, we're going to have an article up on our website by Janet called Primer on the Brain. So this is going to be the first of a series of articles that Janet has promised. I'm putting her on the spot. Janet has promised, and we're going to get them up on our website to start this conversation in a more formal way. We'll send you an email on this. Next month, on August 30th at 4 p.m., our guest will be Carol Reebok, and she will be speaking on another interesting topic that's somewhat related, actually, is how technology both facilitates and undermines our connection and communication. So she's written a good article about that. Again, thank you, Janet. Thank you all for being here. Please tell your friends and colleagues about Wise Talk. This is how we get the word out, and we'll see you all or hear you all next month. Thank you.
Thank you.